Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined on the show by Jeffrey Gerard, who wrote the book Truthers. It's listed as a young adult thriller, but I read it and couldn't put it down. Jeffrey Gerard is the author of several other books, including Project Kane, a 2013 Bram Stoker Award nominee for superior achievement in a young adult novel. He has degrees in English literature and creative writing. He currently lives in Ohio, where he chairs the English department at a private boys' high school. And this is what a few people have said about his book. Quote, with compelling characters and nonstop action, Truthers will leave you thinking. And another comment about the book is, quote, Gerard is a skilled storyteller, weaving history and conspiracy into a thriller that's bold, smart, and impossible to put down. And the last quote I'll share with you about the book says, it examines one of the most critically regarded events in history through the eyes of a tenacious teen who kept me up at night challenging the things I previously regarded as fact. A deep yet approachable story, both thrilling and touching. Jeffrey Gerard's book, Truthers, came out in 2017, and here he is to discuss it with us. Jeffrey Gerard, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for inviting me on. Appreciate it.
Maybe you can tell us what motivated you to write the book, Truthers.
Well, I am a high school English teacher, and very often, especially with my young adult fiction, so I teach high school, but I write on the side, and my students will sometimes bring stuff up that gets me noodling. And let's see, my freshmen weren't alive when 9/11 happened, and my seniors were, what, 2 or 3 years old, maybe. And so the only thing they really know about 9/11, or quite honestly, in quotes, the only thing they really care about it, because it's ancient history to them. I mean, they weren't either alive or, it's, you know, they were 3 years old. So the only thing that really interests them or that they know about is the conspiracy stuff. And that's sort of their starting point. Or at least that's how I saw it, as a starting point. As a teacher, my job is to figure out, okay, what are high school kids interested in? And if I can use that to get them to Edgar Allan Poe or Shakespeare or, you know, what happened on 9/11, something that happened before they were born, then I'll take that opportunity. So they're interested in the conspiracy stuff, and I started from there. I imagine this tale where a high school girl is in the exact same boat that my current students are, where they've heard of 9/11, yeah, they kind of know what happened, but haven't given it any real serious thought. And as the character in the book explores more, she sort of uncovers more stuff that makes her uncomfortable and does the digging that, you know, people don't really do anymore. The idea.
And so had you already done research on 9/11, or was it your students' questioning that made you actually do the research yourself?
Done a little bit. I mean, I'm of an age that, you know, I was alive when it happened. So for me, I'd done some reading on my own and was certainly, like, I'm trying to, like, where do I want to admit to being on the spectrum on these things? I never felt that the public has gotten full disclosure by any means on what happened. And so just as a citizen, yes, I had read a little bit and had read some books. And so the interest was there, and I'd done a little bit of reading. And I think when these guys sort of started asking questions one day, and I realized that I was teaching kids who weren't alive when it happened, and the only thing they know about it is, you know, some very easy joke like, oh, Bush did it. And I'm like, well, do you even know what that means? Like, when you say that, what exactly are you saying? And they're like, oh, you know, and to just sort of take it from there. Then I did a ton of reading. Research is my favorite part of writing, and that has been the case for whatever it is I'm writing about. And so I did easily 6 months of research before I wrote down a single word of this book. I went off and read just about everything I could get my hands on, all sides of what happened that day, official versions, unofficial versions, questions of, et cetera, et cetera.
And why a novel? Why did you choose to write a novel as opposed to a nonfiction book about 9/11?
That's a good question. Again, I guess I think that that's, that's sort of me trying to bridge to a group that might not otherwise have read the book kind of thing. I thought by couching it in nonfiction that the reader could experience this through the eyes with this main character. The character in the book, Katie, like I said, she's a teen girl, and her father says you're a survivor of the 9/11 conspiracy, and that when passengers were taken off the plane that day and drones were sent instead, that you were sort of snuck off the plane, and we've been raising you ever since, sort of secretly. And so she has to explore all sides, both sides, do her research, do some homework, go into some places that are, you know, darker or more off-field than she expected, but also to sort of take some of that a little more seriously than she might have, and also to look into the history of that day and the history of what came after 9/11, what led up to, perhaps, historically, politically kind of thing. And it just seemed like fiction was a good place. Well, it's funny, we were just talking about it. We just started a new semester today in class. I teach a horror class also. When I was talking about how fiction, from what all English teachers say, fiction is a great allegory. It's a bridge and avenue to discuss real things, but sort of, I don't know, I don't want to say protects is not the right word, but it allows you to talk about things that you might not otherwise be able to talk about in a comfortable way. And so I think by setting this in a fictional world and having these characters sort of wrestle with these questions, it felt like it was a safe space that a teenager might be introduced to 9/11.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned Katie, and the basis of the book is basically around her and the Cleveland airport and what happened there on 9/11. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about what happened at the Cleveland airport on 9/11.
Well, I don't know. I can certainly say that I don't know what happened. I know certainly there was a lot of attention specifically at the Cleveland airport on 9/11. I mean, I know the mayor up there either misspoke or not, and mentioned a plane number that he shouldn't even have known yet. And I know that there are certainly witnesses who claim to have seen all sorts of planes coming in that day, and, you know, sort of people being let off for questions. And, you know, I imagine every airport in the country was all heck was breaking loose that day. So, but the Cleveland airport just kept coming up as sort of like a spot where, here is a theory, here is the main theory with the Cleveland airport, is this idea that that was the spot where they brought in the different flights. If, for instance, you believe or are curious or think that perhaps the planes were replaced with drones or, you know, military planes or something like that, and that we have a pretty good idea that, again, there's so many if. If you believe the passengers went up that day and did not go into the buildings, but in fact there is the possibility, there is the belief, that they were instead brought to sort of the Cleveland airport and all sort of led off together somewhere, and there's five different places on where that might be, that somewhere might be, but that it seems that, like, Cleveland seems to be the hot spot for this, where it might have happened. It makes sense for where planes sort of vanished off radar for a little bit, and It's close to where things sort of turned around, and it's close. It's sort of like a good location for where these planes might have landed and some funny business might have happened. So it seems like a lot of attention focuses there. And what this novel presupposes is that perhaps something did happen there, and that this is where this girl was sort of snuck off one of the planes, like, you know, Moses and the bulrushes kind of thing, and has been raised ever since.
So I thought that was an interesting way to start the book and connect it to your local area with your students being in Ohio, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and what kind of reaction have you gotten from your students about the book?
That's funny. The strongest reaction you get, and I don't know about you, what you encounter out in the world, because the folks who are just like, oh, yeah, this is kind of cool, or this is interesting, or I didn't know that, you get that group. The biggest reaction you get are the people who, like, can't stand the idea of the book, like the idea that that's even possible. And I, of course, encourage that. I mean, as a teacher, that's fantastic. So it's funny, the strongest reactions I've gotten are the guys who come in and like, dude, this is ridiculous. I don't even understand why you're writing it. But there are also guys that have bought the book, right? So they're like reading it, and they come back and they're telling me like, oh, you know, I'm a chapter here and this and that. And they're not complaining about the book or how bad the book is or something. They're not buying the premise necessarily. But they keep pushing through it, and then we come in and have those conversations. And for me, that's a win. That's as a teacher, as a writer, that's all I ever want. I want those conversations. So the strongest reaction is the, no, there's no way that would ever happen kind of stuff. But those turn into good conversations. And other than that, just general support, cool book and interesting book and all that kind of stuff. Actually, this year, one of the other teachers in the school is going to use it. He's doing something on sort of media literacy, and they're studying conspiracy theories because they're so, I mean, they've been around for 1,000 years, but getting more and more popular for a host of reasons. So he's actually going to do a unit on conspiracy theory, and he plans to use this book. I won't yet. That's too brazen on my part, but another one of the teachers in the school plans to.
And the students, you say, have a real interest in the conspiracy stuff, so that is one way to get them reading and discussing and thinking.
Right, absolutely.
I was doing some tabling in Maine at a fair the past few years, and the students, it's the young kids, the students who come to me and they say, you know, we're studying 9/11 in our classes, and they wanted our stuff. They are leaning more towards the conspiracy side as opposed to what the government's telling us, which I find encouraging because it does show some critical thinking on their part. So I've had that similar experience with students that age.
I mean, the same thing happened with Kennedy. It's just sort of like each generation, the percentages of people that believe that something funny happened there, just it increases with every generation. I mean, every decade you can add 10% to the people who believe that there was a major conspiracy involved.
Right, and I think if you didn't live through the propaganda that the media and the government put out right when the events happen, you haven't been brainwashed or conditioned to believe what they're telling you. So I think younger kids tend to be more open because they didn't live through that. That's my take on it anyway.
No, it makes sense.
So what, you did a lot of research for the book, obviously. What resources did you find most helpful? Are there any that you would recommend?
For the back of the book, I have sort of the bibliography. I don't want to rip on the commission report, but I started there. David Ray Griffin, I'm sure, is a name that you and anyone listening to this knows very well. So I found his books very, very helpful. I went back to them a lot. Again, I try to do both sides, all sides, various things. He was sort of like the cornerstone. Like I said, there's a bibliography in the book. I don't even want to pick certain people out.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, actually. And you have David Ray Griffin here, of course. You have Kevin Ryan, Another 19, Michael Rupert. Those are all great.
Rupert's was good, yeah. Thank you for calling that one out.
Crossing the Rubicon. Yeah. And then you also have Jonathan Kay here. I know you were trying to be neutral and present both sides, but but his book, Among the Truthers, I found to be the biggest piece of propaganda.
You know what? I'm going to try to stay relatively unbiased through this on that one. I agree with you. I found, you know, I had to put it in there. I mean, I didn't have to put it in there. I thought it was fair to put it in there. Because I read it, and my copy of that book is written in the margins and across paragraphs, and it's basically me just yelling at this guy. Yes, I thought there were sections that were very well done, and I thought there were sections that were completely sort of like snotty and obnoxious, and like he'd say something, and I'm just sitting there, and I think I'm pretty in the middle on this, open to many ideas, and he would say something, and I'd be like, dude, that is just really disrespectful. But, you know, yeah, I mean, that's out there.
He had a lot of sort of ad hominem attacks in there on people in the truth movement.
I thought so, too. Like, yeah. Completely, like, dude, like, unnecessary. Sorry, just dude him. But yeah. Unnecessary.
But that was, like, the point of the book is to make people who were investigating it look stupid or something. So,
Actually, you know what? I'm going to say it. For your listeners, anyone who wants to read the book, I encourage you to... I certainly encourage you to read my book, Truthers. Read the book, and I'm going to tell you straight up, I'm not going to get into it. Never mind, you can edit that. Let's put it this way. There's a recording of the book that's done wonderfully. It's the reader is fantastic, and she does Katie's voice so well. And it's so does a fantastic job. Disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. Seriously. But I feel even there, I felt there are times when specifically the quote-unquote truther characters are being presented, I don't think they're being presented in the best light by the folks who put that, the audio version.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it's just like, it's not really the voice I imagined, and the voices always seem to be a little silly to me, the folks that are most presenting information that's sort of out the mainstream. I'm reading too much into it, but it seemed just like the K book. It was the same kind of thing. It was just sort of a little bit dismissive.
Right.
Usually people who, as I say in the book and Truthers, they go to a convention And the young genius that she's hanging out with on this little journey points out that, like, hey, this is a room of smart people. Like, these are professionals, right? These are programmers and lawyers and businessmen and women and people with degrees. It's usually the more professional group that's in this room asking these questions. So maybe I do get a little, like, not a group you want to make fun of.
Right. I agree with you on that. And I think sometimes these companies are so nervous that they have to put that sort of spin on it to get it out, to get it published.
I agree. The book's not in there. The publisher is fantastic. And again, if you like audiobooks, give it a shot. I think she did an amazing job with the main character, but I do feel like a couple of the more traditional, quote-unquote, truther characters, I just felt like, what is that voice they're doing? That seems unnecessary. Not because the main truther in the book, there's a character who sort of does sort of what you do. He runs a radio show and he has podcasts and he puts stuff up online and stuff. And I don't know, I just felt like he could have gotten a little more respect in that. He does in the book.
And I really want to encourage people to read your book, even if you don't care about the topic of 9/11. It was a really, like, a great book to read. It was, I couldn't put it down. So it was great.
You.
Yeah, really well written and everything. So, yeah, I applaud you on that. And I just, while we're commenting about the bibliography, you also have in here Anthony Summers and Robin Swan and The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11. And I found that book to be pure propaganda also. They put in just enough to kind of say they've covered it, but they don't give you the real details. And one example is they talk about April Gallup, who was in the Pentagon on 9/11. And they quote her, but they don't quote the real things that she said, like that there was no plane that hit the Pentagon, there was no body parts, no luggage, no plane parts. So it's not the full story of 9/11, even though that's their title. Anyways, and you also mentioned Michelle Chesedovsky, who I think is wonderful from Global Research, the website. So I like that. Is there anything you'd like to say about the book that I haven't asked you?
Just that I suppose that the book's main goal is to encourage people of all ages, you know, starting with teens, but it's also for adults, too, because we had conversations with the adults today. We're arguing about various political things, and we were arguing about truth or whatever and how to get to truth. And, you know, so truthers, why 9/11 is the sort of cornerstone of what it is, what the book's really getting at is how we as citizens, whether you're 15 or 65, how we break through this, like, selective exposure that we've created for ourselves. It's like we watch the news channels that fit with what we believe, and technology is so amazing. I mean, the fact that you and I are doing this, right? We're talking
right
on the phone, and you're going to put it up, and someone in China could listen to this. I mean, it's amazing, it's powerful, it's necessary, it opens a free world. But it also is so, so messy, because you end up, I mean, I've caught myself doing it on Twitter. You know, let's face it, this is a tough political year for wherever you are, and I found myself sort of blocking people, you know, that move, and people do it all the time, right? Facebook and Twitter and this and that and the other thing, your news feeds, you pick and choose. I want to hear from these people, I don't want to hear from these people, and I'm interested, and 9/11 is sort of like I said, it's a cornerstone of this interest, but how in the future, how in the present, how are we going to make decisions and know truth when we sort of, we're putting ourselves in specific little ponds, you know, selective exposure. Like, I only want to hear from these people, from these sources, and it becomes this huge echo chamber so fast that the book's point was two things. One, to encourage teens and 90-year-olds to get out of that pond a little bit and check out other ponds. That way you're not being snotty, right, when you're talking about someone who believes something differently than you do. Should be an intellectual discussion. It should be a discussion in which you bring up facts and you argue a little bit and you say, hey, why this and you have that, and you go through that. I think that should be part of the process of being a citizen. Sounds super corny, but that's, otherwise we're just going to be in these little, small little teapots saying things to each other, surrounded by, you know, we'll be preaching to the choir every day. That's all anyone will be doing, and that's not going to be effective. The other thing was what to do with, I've almost, as the book went on, I almost gave up on, not in a negative way, I almost gave up on, like, finding truth. I don't even know if it's possible, which is probably becomes too philosophic, and it's, I don't know if we're ever going to know what happened on 9/11, or what happened at this election, or what happened with Kennedy, or what happened to the Lucidity. I don't know if we're ever going to know these things. And even the people that were involved, how many fully know what happened? And so I'm trying to do something, I think, thematically with the book, and maybe a takeaway, and hopefully this, I found strength in this, instead of being sort of nervous or bothered by that, I'm not saying I'm going to give up searching. I think the search for the truth is probably like my favorite thing on earth to do. At the end of the day, it's sort of like, what do you do with your version of the truth, right? Like, you're going to gather all this information, and you know what? I've really thought about this, and here's what I think happened. I'm more interested in that next step. So therefore, what do? You, for instance, you started this show, right? And you reach out to people, mm-hmm. and you're involved, and you sat at that table, and you talked to the high school. Like, what will you do? So whatever you believe happened this year in the election, or this or that or the other thing, like, what did you do the next morning? Did you get up? Did you run for office? Did you start volunteering here or there? Did you go down here and do some more local service? Did you write a book about this? Did you start researching? Like, what action did you take based on your truth?
Don't be a passive citizen. Yes, I hear you. Don't be passive and get involved.
Yeah. Because we're going to argue with each other for 10,000 years on what the truth is on any given event. I think we should. Afterward, what are you doing with your version of truth? How are you going to make the world better? Now that you think that that's the version of the truth, what will you do to make this a better place?
Right. Knowledge alone isn't enough. You do have to take some action, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But I do have to say, I understand what you're saying when you say we don't know, we may never know what happened, but I have to disagree a little bit, because in the Kennedy assassination, there is so much research that I think we do have a pretty good idea of what happened, and certainly we have a good idea what didn't happen. And we also, on 9/11, I mean, there's mountains of evidence. We kind of do know the general outline of what happened and what didn't happen, and we don't have all the details, but... And with the assassination of Martin Luther King, I mean, we know that. We know, the author William Pepper has done a great book on that. He's done 30 years of research. We kind of know. There's a knowing, and then there's a public acknowledgement of what we know. And I think that's what we're not getting, is the public, government, media, corporate media acknowledgement of what we do know. I understand what you're saying, but I think there is a fake news. The real fake news is the alphabet soup corporate media, really. Your thoughts?
Understood.
Okay. You're not going to...
No, I understand what you were saying, and I do not disagree with it.
Okay. Well, is there any part of the book, would you like to read an excerpt from the book?
Okay, fair enough. I should be able to do the first chapter, right? I'll just start there, because if that doesn't grab your interest, then I have failed. But if there are more, they know where to go. All right.
Okay.
Chapter 1, Truthers. They killed her. Killed all of them. This is what her father said. Half a dozen times that she could remember, when he was very tired and high, they killed her, killed all of them. I'm sorry. He'd said it again two nights before they took him away. The police car that pulled up to her house at night didn't surprise or alarm Katie. It wasn't the first time. Neighbors could be so noisy. She'd even seen her father arrested once, misdemeanor marijuana. But this night, there were two police cars, an especially marked sheriff's office car. And now a black car in a weird yellow van pulling up her driveway. Her immediate guess was that her father was dead, reeking of pot and or beer, and wrapped around some telephone pole, or worse and more likely, smashed into an SUV filled with some family who'd been racing on the tangled pathways of destiny toward this unhappy man for years. It finally happened, she thought. And now all these cars, all these people huddled in small circles up and down her driveway, people talking, pointing, organizing to fully include her in today's tragedy. Katie stepped back from the window, the world quiet and still, as she deliberated how to behave when they officially told her. Cry, scream, act surprised. She felt too disconnected from herself for real thought, her brain unexpectedly empty, this space for rent, entirely without the solutions that always came. Finally, a knock at the door, thank God, she thought. Because a knock was a sound, and sound was something real and hinted at next steps, at least a next step. And she opened her front door slowly, and a tall shadow filled the space behind. Caitlin Wallace? The tall shadow asked. She managed only a nod. It was as if Death himself had come to her door, dropping by to explain all the complexities of the universe. She almost found the idea funny, and might even have laughed if she weren't also so terrified. Death leaned forward, and of course became a man. Round face, gray goatee, no side or glistening black eye sockets, but a leather folder and a black baseball cap that said Sheriff. Sheriff Matheson, he confirmed, and asked her if he could come in. More shadows hovered directly behind him, and there was some discussion regarding whether she was a Caitlin or a Kate or etc., and she may have answered, but wasn't really listening yet, merely staring. Outside, the nasty rainstorm that had swept through had passed, its gloom and dankness trailing after, and some cops stood posted in their driveway. A half dozen neighbors confirmed their noisiness, their faces flush and hellish in the lone red light revolving slowly atop one of the police cars. The sheriff had entered her house, and then half a dozen other equally tall, dark shapes, several men in suits, another cop, and a woman in plain clothes, followed him and crowded her hallway as Katie was led to a living room, already a guest in her own home. "This is Gloria Dorsey," the sheriff said, introducing the woman. She was middle-aged, dressed like a modest school teacher, short, jagged blonde hair. She looked eager to take over. "Miss Dorsey, is he dead?" Katie asked. She also wanted to take over, but still felt weirdly apart from her own words and movements. The sheriff sighed, almost chuckled. "Oh, no, little lady, no, no, no. Your dad is fine," the Dorsey woman said. She'd taken a spot beside Katie on the couch, though Katie had no recollection of even sitting. Struggling for the reaction to the idea her father was still alive proved as elusive as what she might do if he were dead. "He's perfectly fine," the woman said. "We should have told you that right away." The woman shot a look at the sheriff, and his whole face tightened some. Katie asked, "Is he in jail?" "He's at the hospital," the sheriff replied. "Wentworth." Katie never heard of it. Behind the sheriff, the others scurried around her house, around it, through it, over it. Doing what, she had no clue. The cop had stayed back in the front hallway, and one man, well, this guy she'd not noticed before. He now stood off to the side in the entrance to the kitchen, watching her. And while all the others moved in a sort of intense frenzy, this guy looked perfectly calm, chewing gum even, almost amused, smiling. "I don't understand," Katie said, looking away, reality returning fast now, pursuing something they'd said. "You said he was fine, so why is he at the hospital?" The sheriff and the Dorsey woman shared a look. "There was an incident at work," Dorsey explained. "Work? Her dad was a maintenance groundskeeper type for park services, cutting out honeysuckle, putting in new picnic tables, etc. What kind of incident would he?" "The doctors believe your father had a panic attack of some kind," said Dorsey. "A nervous breakdown," the sheriff amended. "So, nothing to do with honeysuckle." "Of course not." Katie thought about some of the things her dad had said to her recently, stranger than usual even. And because it was tricky to separate them all, she even thought about some of the things he'd said for many years. A breakdown. His whole damn life had been a breakdown. "They don't know for sure what it was," Dorsey said, interrupting Katie's racing thoughts. "But he's gone to spend at least tonight at the hospital." Pause. "Maybe longer. And he was worried about you here being alone." Katie made a face, calling Dorsey's lie. She spent most of her life alone in the house, this one and all the others before it, while her father was off fishing or holed up in some nasty bar after work or God knows what. He wouldn't give one shit if she spent another night alone. "We were worried," Dorsey corrected, and then presented her most professional, "I know what you're going through" face before her next words. "You're a minor, Katie." Finally, Katie realized what was going on. Her dad was already at some hospital. They hadn't come for him. They'd come for her. There was no known next of kin. No grandparents or aunts or second cousins. No one. Only her dad, a.k.a. the man in prison in some psychiatric hospital called Vent Something. And so the Dorsey woman helped Katie collect her school bag and fill a county supply gym bag, said Butler County Social Services right on the side, with some clothes, and then led her to the weird yellowy van, and the sheriff followed. Katie had gone on autopilot again. She had little memory of stepping outside or moving down the rain-stained driveway with Dorsey or getting into the van. She sat alone in the middle row of seats while Dorsey shut the side door and then got in to drive. The night still swirling red, neighbors still watching, Mrs. Lindhurst and Gary the Grouch, their stares. And as the van pulled away with her in it, Katie noticed all the lights in her house were still on, the front door wide open, strange men still within. "I want to see my father," Katie said. "Soon," Dorsey replied from up front, but she was lying.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Again, I want to encourage people to read your book, and I think one of the benefits of doing a fiction, a novel about this, is that libraries will carry it where they won't carry some of the other 9/11 truth books that are nonfiction, so that it reaches more people. So I really want to thank you, Jeff, for writing the book and for coming on the show today.
Like I said, thank you so much for inviting me on today and talking to me. I appreciate it.
Okay, and what's next for you? Another book in the works?
Many, many books, yes. Let's see, what's next? I'm writing a book about a Japanese samurai, a book set in 1600s Japan. I spent a month in Japan this summer, and all my research is based on old Japan, feudal Japan right now.
Well, good luck with that, and thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with author Jeffrey Gerard, who wrote the book that came out in 2017 called Truthers. It's a young adult thriller, but most adults I know really enjoyed reading it, and I would highly recommend it. And I want to thank Carl Seeger Henry, who introduced me to this book over lunch a few months ago. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.